Today we have a juxtaposition of events, which of course, by the nature of the calendar, will always be together. September 11th is a well-known date now in American history, and September 12th is a well-known date in Ananda history. And on one level, they don't exactly seem to go together. Kriyananda, the founder of Ananda's meeting with Yogananda in 1948, was the signal for many of us who find inspiration through Ananda. It was a day our souls rejoiced, whether we were in physical incarnation or waiting in the astral world, in the great timelessness of eternity. It was obvious that a drama was playing out and that that drama was going to have great effect on all of us. Many of you in this room really may never even have heard of Swami Kriyananda or know him only tangentially. But if you're even in this room, far more than you may realize, you are the beneficiaries of his lifetime of discipleship. And far more than any of us realize, all of us are the beneficiaries of the fact that Paramhansa Yogananda was inspired by God to take physical form and incarnate on this earth starting in 1893 to 1952. When he passed away, Kriyananda came in 1948, I was born in 1947, you were born in, and it goes on and on and on and on. And then 10 years ago on September 11th, I'm sure many of you remember it as vividly as I do, you know, something happened in America that had never happened before, which is a foreign-inspired violence took place on our soil. You know, for many people in the world, the presence of war and violence, invasions from outside, civil wars, and so on, are commonplace. On the very day that there was a celebration in downtown Palo Alto, a memorial service, it was within a day or two of September 11th, 10 years ago, among other things, this being Palo Alto, they had several Muslim people speaking, and they had a Lebanese man from Stanford University, a man in his early 20s, who said, by the time I was 10, my house had been bombed 5 times. And, you know, it's just like all the American kids who grow up and the biggest problem is whether you make the soccer team or not. It's really hard for us to comprehend a childhood that is characterized by events like that. And even still, although many things have changed in our country in this last decade, we still pretty much live business as usual. You know, there's a little bit more anxiety in there. I remember when many years ago, this was 20 or more years ago, there was some kind of a terrorist event in the Rome airport. People came in with guns, and the details are not clear to me. You see how memory is, but I remember it as being one of the first complete incursions of violence into an otherwise stable and safe place. Not long after that event in Rome, David and I traveled to Europe for one reason or another, and I remember going into the Rome airport and seeing soldiers stationed, you know, all over the airport, all of them holding machine guns, automatic weapons, and looking very combat ready. And the most interesting part of my reaction was how happy I was to see them there. You know, far from being horrified at the presence of armed guards in the airport, it was comforting to me to see them. And so little by little, our sense of reality has shifted, and that which was unthinkable becomes ordinary to us. That which would have caused us to be shocked, instead we're comforted. Strange, isn't it? You know, there are countless examples in the course of our own lives of how things just shift and shift. On September 11th, it's ironic because David and I, you know, are not in the habit of having the news on. And I actually heard about the September 11th event from Swami Kriyananda, who phoned us from Italy and said, turn on your television or your radio. There's something happening in America you need to know about. And somehow or another, the word got to him before it even got to us. And of course we did, and then the rest of his history, literally, what we saw. Now, one of the most interesting things to me is that one of the largest religious services we have ever had here in this temple was the Sunday right after that. And in a sense, it was a very comforting reality, because what happened was, people in their anxiety and in their insecurity and in suddenly having pulled out from under their feet the solid rug of safety that we have always considered America to be, many of them decided that the proper response was to worship. So you have to ask yourself sometimes, you know, if something draws us toward God, if something wakes us up to a deeper level of understanding, to a more eternal perspective on our own lives, is the catalyzing event a tragedy or a blessing? And when we come to this, we come to the entire question of what are we doing on this planet? What is the meaning of our life and why are we here? Which brings us back to Paramhansa Yogananda and his disciple Swami Kriyananda. Yogananda tells us in his, most of these come through books that Swami Kriyananda has written of things that Yogananda said. Very soon after Swami arrived as a disciple to Yogananda, Master as we call him, said to him, write down what I say. And the obvious implication was someday you will publish books talking about what I say. So from the beginning, Kriyananda took notes. And then over the course of his lifetime, he's published in various books, The Essence of Self-Realization, we were reading from, Conversations with Yogananda, The New Path. Many of his books include long sections of verbatim repeats of what things that Yogananda said. And in the course of Yogananda's conversation with his disciples, he made it clear to them that this lifetime living in this body called Paramhansa Yogananda, born in India, coming to America, was not the first time that the same soul, the word in Sanskrit is jiva, the same individualized expression of spirit had taken physical form to play some significant role in the way, in the history of this planet Earth. In fact, the more Yogananda talks, the more you hear about how all of these masters have reincarnated again and again on this planet. And as Swamiji says, without being able to declare it as gospel truth, it looks like these masters have had a certain spiritual responsibility for the progress of this world. Now, you expect then that these great figures will be great religious figures. And Swami Master tells us that the three wise men that visited Jesus in the manger were three of the gurus on the altar here, Sri Yukteswar, Lahiri, and Babaji. That those wise men from the east coming to the babe in the manger were this same line of avatars who were all part of that spiritual message, that spiritual destiny that Jesus played out. And that the lost years of Jesus were not lost at all. They were simply erased from the Bible. But the unknown years of Jesus were that Jesus, when he became man enough to seek out his own destiny, and these great masters play out a human drama for us. They don't just show up on the planet and everything for them goes easy. Like, what kind of example would that be? If here I am a great avatar and I'm going to teach you how to live and I never have to do anything. I just go like this. I have all the money I want. I go like this. I have all the loyal followers I want. I go like this and my health is perfect. I mean, what would we learn except maybe I want his job? You know, it looks better to me than the one I've got, right? So they actually play the part. And it's one of those divine mysteries which we can discuss at another time about how and why, but they actually play the part. One of the parts they have to play is spiritual seeking, because we have to understand that to receive the divine within us, we have to develop ourselves to be capable of doing so. We have to enlarge, so to speak, the cup that we hold up to the infinite so that more than just a drop or two of the divine can come into it. So Jesus, when he became man enough to do it, went to India, went to Tibet, went to Nepal, and studied with the same masters who had come to visit him. And then Yogananda talked about that Babaji in an earlier incarnation was Krishna, and that his chief disciple Arjuna, and the whole Bhagavad Gita is a dialogue between Krishna and Arjuna. Yogananda said he himself was Arjuna, and that Babaji was Krishna. Now, your mind begins to sort of think a little differently. You may think that these are just fairy tales, and that's, you know, what you can decide if you wish to think. But when you have experience of the veracity, the absolute truthfulness of so much of what these masters say, when they move outside of what we can easily verify, there's at least an inclination not to disbelieve. There's an inclination to think, well, how do I know it's not true? And then as the pieces begin to come together, a picture of this world emerges that is so much more expansive, so much more interesting, so much more coherent, and in the end, so much more comforting than the sort of random musings of the ego-based mind trying to build things up from what I learned in elementary school, you know, and what I was told when I went to high school, and what some poor, with mostly due respect, you know, misguided professors tried to tell me in college, who did not exemplify in their own lives a life that I thought was worth emulating. You see, the way the masters and the great teachers of our time, of which, of course, these gurus are among them in Swami Kriyananda, is also the reason they capture our imagination is not merely, although it's helpful, by the interesting and intelligent nature of their teachings, but it's by the example of their own lives. As Swami Kriyananda wrote about Autobiography of a Yogi, he said there was so much in it when he read that book at the age of 22 in 1948, and he got to master on September 12th, and he got the book about 5 days before that, maybe six or seven. He read the book in New York City. As soon as he was finished, he closed it. He got a bus ticket. He came across the United States. He went to where Yogananda says, the first words he spoke were, "I want to be your disciple." But Swami Kriyananda was the first to admit there was so much in the book, Autobiography of a Yogi, that just, well, to use the modern vernacular, blew his mind. He just didn't know where to put it. You know, people materializing and dematerializing, acting out of two bodies at the same time, being resurrected from the astral world. Sri Yukteswar giving a detailed description of the astral world, which includes mermaids and gnomes and leprechauns and fairies. That's like a sentence that the first 10 times you read the book, you just pass right over it because you just don't even know where to put it, you know? In fact, I asked Swami about that recently. I said, like, when you're a leprechaun, do you then become a mermaid after you're a mermaid? Like, where is the logical progression? He gave a very interesting answer. He said it's separate lines of development. You know, it's still ego-based identification with a particular form, but I guess you just kind of just go along being a mermaid until you're a mermaid avatar? I don't know. Sometimes when I ask Swami questions like this too much, for those of you who are going to end up hearing this on audio, you won't get it, so I'll just show you. I asked Swamiji a question about, you know, this kind of question about 1,000 different things. He was eating breakfast. He put down his fork. He raised his two arms silently. He shrugged his shoulders like this, you know, in the sort of the ultimate gesture of who knows, and then picked up his fork again and finished breakfast. And then another occasion, he said, "We have to leave." His master said this too, "A few mysteries to be unraveled later." But nonetheless, you know, as we live here, we have to unravel at least some of those mysteries. Maybe we don't know how mermaids and fairies and gnomes fit into our everyday life, but we have to have some answers to much more concrete problems. Like, I feel miserable, and I've been abandoned by the people I trusted, and my children have not turned out the way I hoped they would turn out, you know, and all of the sacrifices I've given have been unappreciated. Or right in the middle of everything just going just right, you know, a key person in my little world has been diagnosed with a terminal illness. Or, as happened 10 years ago, people went off to work and never came back. I mean, they literally vaporized. They were just gone. And I'm sure you've all read as many poignant stories as I've read about just what that experience was like. I was reflecting, though, and I don't mean in any way to diminish any individual's experience, but just a little bit of history. You know, we no longer really celebrate December 7th, but for a great many Americans, of course, that was Pearl Harbor. And that was also an extraordinary day in which business as usual was totally interrupted, and many people went off to work as usual and never came home. Children were orphaned. men and women were left without spouses, parents were left without children. And those questions demand answers. But we can never come to answers that are totally satisfying as long as we try to pull that answer down into a little cup of consciousness that we're not willing to expand. When we say to life, these are the conditions and this is what I'm going to understand. I want this, I want this, I want this, this is what I'm going to have. And God, you have to answer my question on my terms. You know, divine answer to that is expand your cup. How can I fill the cup with a faith that is a different shape, a different type, and so much larger even than the questions you're asking? I've been giving a seminar recently based on Yogananda's book, Whispers from Eternity, which is a book he calls of answered prayers. It's just an absolutely glorious book. And in it, he said, these prayers came, they come the reverse of how we pray. The way we pray is we have a need. Something is going wrong in my life. Oh God, please fix it, if we're inclined to pray. Please fix it, please fix it. And then we make all kinds of promises. I know that I haven't been good until now, but I promise you if you do this for me, then I'll be really good after that. As if, you know, somehow God is just like hoping that we'll get our act together. Well, he is hoping we'll get our act together. But as if this is like meaningful, like he really needs more prayers. You know, he doesn't really. We can't buy our way into it, is what I'm trying to say. I'll be good now if you'll just do what I want. What Yogananda writes in that book, he says so simply, he said, God can't break his own karmic laws. You know, this whole world is an orderly place. It appears random to us for one reason only, our perspective is too small. In the many years that I've known Swami Kriyananda, I have developed total faith, is the only way to describe it, total faith in his perception. And I didn't come to that just sort of blindly. Oh, here I am, now you think for me. No such luck is what I say. When people talk about the guru is just going to take over your life, I say, no such luck. You know, this is still our destiny that has to be worked out. But over the many years of living closely and working closely with Swami Kriyananda, I discovered whenever I thought he was wrong or misguided or hadn't picked the issue up from the right string, it was always because I had a box, I had a frame of a certain size, and I would watch whatever the situation was enter at the corner of my frame, cross the frame, and then disappear. And what I began to realize is that Swami Kriyananda was watching the situation start from, you know, a block and a half outside my frame. And he was watching a flow that was going like that, and it would cross my frame and then exit on the other side into the future. And so naturally, the cause and effect relationship in that picture was not always clear within my frame. And I was fortunate that he would often explain himself to me, and I would begin to see, oh, given this karmic trend, given this reality, given this inclination, given the fact that the goal is entirely different from the divine point of view. Understand, the divine point of view is our best interest. God, our Heavenly Father, our Divine Mother, they have one desire for us, which is that we experience infinite bliss, that we become free of all that ails us. And what primarily ails us is that we're just too small. Our definition of reality is this one body, this one incarnation, this one set of relationships, the pleasures that are possible to us, and the desires that we want right now. We have no idea what the implications of most of what we're doing is. We don't know how we got here, and for the most part, we don't know where we're going. I heard a marvelous simple definition of reincarnation just recently. And the individual speaking said, we tend to think of reincarnation as we've got this life, then we have this life, then we have this life, and we had these others before, and we go to psychics and we're told all these interesting things that we did, and then we imagine, you know, what will I be next? And then people always get very confused about, will I be a goat? Will I be a pig? You know, will I be a person? All of those different things. But this explanation was really simple. There's no such thing as reincarnation. The true statement is there's no such thing as death. which, as you see, is a completely different way of looking at it. It's not like we have this one, then we lose it, then we have this one, then we lose it. Not at all. It's that there is one continuous flow of life that is a wave emanating from the ocean of spirit, and it rises and it falls and it rises and it falls. And just as that the ocean comes in, you stand at the beach and we're endlessly fascinated. We're endlessly fascinated by those things that, even if we're not consciously aware of it, communicate to us a bigger reality than the one we normally live in. I mean, think how long you can stand just watching the ocean waves just flow, watching a river flow. Water is such a magnificent image of the spirit because it's always the same and always different. And you see how it changes and doesn't change. That the ocean makes a big wave, the ocean makes a small wave, the ocean crashes against a rock, the ocean comes gently in across the sand and goes out again. But the ocean is always the same. Now, our destiny, our true nature, is to be fully conscious of that infinite ocean. But we get trapped in this deep identification with this one wave. And then even more than that, we begin to determine, just from our own minds, the most interesting reflection is to ask yourself, why do I think this is true? Where did this idea come from? What makes me so sure I'm right? Because so much of what we think and do is just a kind of arbitrary habit that just got started. This is the nature of creation. Our senses look outward. They give us a lot of evidence, and that evidence seems fairly convincing. But then over the course of many experiences of many different waves, we sort of begin to develop a suspicious sense that something completely other is going on here. And God sends, through the ages, his self-realized sons who come to us and declare to us, you know, this world that you live in is really very different than what it appears to be. And they don't speak that from looking it up in a book. They speak that from the fact that they look at this world in the same world from through it, the same body that we're looking at, but they're not limited by all of these little ego ideas. They're not identified with the wave. They're a wave that has begun to understand where it came from and where it's going and what it truly is. Ever and again, through your awakened sons, the answer comes. That's what we say in our Festival of Light. All that we thought was light was but darkness. Who are we in reality? For what end were we made? And we ask that question out of the tremendous longing of our hearts for perfect love, for perfect happiness, for freedom from fear. These are God-inspired desires. And even our love for one another and all of the little human ways in which we express it are not outside of God's will or his desire for us. They're not sinful or negative in any way. They're all part of what the wave is going to do. They're all part of that beautiful dance that we can watch endlessly in the symbol of the ocean. And the wave does all these extraordinary things, and then it's sucked back into the ocean. And we can accept that sort of theoretically until one wave that we're particularly attached to gets sucked back into the ocean. And whether that wave gets sucked back sort of in a timely manner with lots of opportunity for us to get ready for it, or whether it happens as it happened in this country 10 years ago, completely unexpectedly, you know, 6,000 waves were just sucked back into the ocean and no one was ready for it. You know, these terrible, shocking events we think are given to us in some way because we're bad or because we're being punished or because nobody is in charge. That's because our frame is too small. Are these in themselves laudable events? No. Are they in themselves, you know, this sort of glorious expression of God's love? No, not really. But they are this extraordinary divine interplay that is the nature of this world. You know, there was a whole force came from another part of the world, a concentrated, determined force that thought it was a good idea to do something that, from our perspective, was a horrible outrage. And I'm not saying that both points of view are equal. I'm only saying that this world is always going to be an interplay of light and shadow. Because this is not our home. And terrible, traumatic, disappointing events are given to us so that we will stop and think, who am I in reality? For what end was I made? No, this is not an easy school. This is not an easy planet. You know, but children don't say, you know, what is the crummiest university I can apply to? You know, we have this thought, where can I learn the most? Where can I be the most challenged? What can I do that will ask of me everything I'm capable of giving? How can I serve? Who can I become? These are God-inspired realities. And there is no limit to the answer, you see, because we are the infinite ocean. And God will again and again and again and again ask us to become bigger than we are. Sometimes through great fulfillment and joy, and sometimes through startling, even terrible disappointment. But in the reading this morning, they were quoting from Master, from Paramhansa Yogananda. He said, am I not always with you? And the question of life is the ability to answer that question. That the knowledge that nothing that comes to us can ever actually separate us from that divine love within. And until we can answer that question again and again, no matter what comes to us, with yes, Lord, I know you're here. I feel your presence. You are always the same with me. Until and unless we can answer that question, God will always be giving us the chance to get bigger. And he helps us. That's the point. And this is where Swami Kriyananda's reality comes into this. Paramhansa Yogananda incarnates. Ever and again through your awakened sons, the answer comes. A great master comes and he, by his very vibration, he puts out this radiant thought. All that you long for in your hearts is true. Everything that you desire to have and to be is yours. And as Jesus said when he walked on the Sea of Galilee and found his disciples, one by one they saw him. And Jesus' words, so remarkable. He looked at his chosen disciples and he said, follow me. One can spend a whole lifetime on those two words, follow me. And where do we follow Jesus? Oh, well, we had to follow him into the crucifixion, didn't we? But if we didn't become afraid and run from that, we could also follow him into the resurrection, which is the triumph over all limitation. We are so fortunate to be so close to Yogananda and to have been guided and inspired by his great disciple, Swami Kriyananda. Because ever and again through these awakened sons, the answer comes, follow me. Live your life for God. In fear and suffering, look beyond and ask God to help you. Why have you done this, Lord? But ask that question, not why have you done this, Lord? But you ask the question, why have you done this, Lord? And in that prayer, for that prayer, there is an answer. God bless you.